Talk Central, the business technology podcast brought to you by the editors at techcentral.co.za. My name is Duncan McLeod and I'm here with Craig Wilson on a freezing cold Friday afternoon. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Duncan.
You're running in slow motion with the cold.
Oh, it's so cold. But otherwise I'm fine. No complaints.
Good. Great. Well, let's get straight into it. There's one story that's really dominated the news over the last 48 hours or so, and that's the news that Visa, the global payments company, has bought a Cape Town. You can't really call them a startup anymore. They've been going for about 10 or 11 years already, but bought a Cape Town mobile payments company, Fundamo. Really interesting development, and certainly paid a lot of cash for it, $110 million all cash deal.
You said it makes it one of the biggest deals in recent years, if not the biggest
If you strip out the obvious Die Data acquisition by Japan's NTT last year, which was
the $24 billion
deal, also all cash, I think this may be the biggest investment in South Africa's technology sector by a foreign company since Mark Shuttleworth sold Thought Consulting to VeriSign back in, I think it was 1999 or 2000, for $575 million.
And of course, speaking of Shuttleworth, he stands to see a little bit of this deal too, I believe,
because
he was one of the sort of angel investors that helped get them going in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. He created this company, HBD, or Here Be Dragons Venture Capital.
Here Be Dragons, yeah.
To fund some of the money he made out of the sale of Thought to VeriSign. And HBD invested in a range of companies, and one of them happens to have been Fundamo, which has now been bought out again. So HBD, I don't know what Mark Shuttleworth's specific stake in HBD is or how he stands to benefit personally from this deal, but certainly this venture capital company he started stands to take home tens of millions of dollars out
absolutely
of this deal.
Yeah, which absolutely. Hopefully, considering their agenda, will be reinvested in other startups.
Yeah, absolutely. I was actually going to have another look at the HBD venture capital portfolio and see what they've got in there. Maybe this isn't going to be the last of these deals we see. But yeah, interesting company. I've known Hannes van Rensburg for many years. I think I interviewed him when he first started Fundamo, and I was still working at the Financial Mail at the time. Interesting guy. He's got an MSc in nuclear reactor physics, so he's not a stupid boy.
No. He's got something to fall back on if it all goes pear-shaped.
Yes. he was formerly the chief information officer at Sanlam, and Sanlam has also provided some of the early capital to fund his business, and they're also walking away with a huge windfall from this.
Sure, I think all of the investors are very happy with this news.
Yeah, definitely. I think that the amount that Visa's paying must far outstrip the amount of money they've actually invested in this company. The three big winners are HBD, which is started by Mark Shuttleworth, Sanlam, and Remgro, which is the tobacco company, which I think is associated with Johan Rupert's empire. So Stellenbosch money,
Mark Shuttleworth. Many bottles of wine down at the coast being popped this week, I'm sure.
Yeah, for sure. But a great deal, and I think Hannes must be over the moon with this acquisition. Visa has said, I interviewed the global head of for mobile payments at Visa yesterday, and he said that the intention is to keep this as a South African company and to keep the development resource here in Cape Town. Good news. And this Visa is a gigantic multinational corporation, and it's going to allow Fundamo to take its mobile payments solutions into markets where perhaps it hasn't had the resources or the ability to do so far.
Absolutely. To have someone of sort of Visa's size and reach behind you, you know, it's completely going to change the way they're able to operate. And I think what's also interesting is that they're billing it as a, you know, they want to sell it as a solution for high-end and low-end and sort of all ends of the spectrum users, which we haven't really seen that much in mobile banking or mobile payment solutions, should I say. A lot of them have had a very specific sort of end of the LSM scale in mind. I think the actual product that comes out with Visa's backing could be really interesting. And of course, it's always nice when it's homegrown.
I mean, the Visa guy made the point that they've already developed some of their own mobile solutions in-house, but specifically around near-field communications technology, which is this short-range wireless technology, which is starting to be built into modern handsets, especially smartphones. Fundamo has really gone after the emerging markets, finding alternative payment solutions for people who are unbanked, really.
Sure. As they said, there's the unbanked and the underbanked.
Yes.
And I think that's also, you know, that's also really valuable because it's another one of these great equalizers.
Mm.
You know, we take access to things like internet banking or easy forms of banking that are convenient and not banking hour specific for granted. But you forget that there are an awful lot of people for whom that's really still not an option and who have to go and suffer through lengthy queues on Friday afternoons when people are paying out wages. And, you know, I think it's really important that the lower end of the market be provided with these sort of options, particularly with cell phone penetration growing so much.
Yeah, it's early days, of course, but it's going to be interesting, very interesting to see how all of this plays out, especially with the mobile operators starting to get into this mobile payments game and seeing it as a market opportunity as well, especially as competition intensifies in their traditional telecommunications businesses.
Absolutely.
And Visa, I presume, and I know that Fundamo has certainly been working with financial institutions, and Visa historically has worked closely with financial services institutions. So I guess that will continue. So I don't think this is going to be so much a play for the mobile operators. It's more interesting for the global payments companies and for the banks. Good. I think we need to segue this next piece with and now for something completely different. you've just written an interesting column based on Gareth Cliff and his plans to sell himself on Twitter and Facebook.
Well, yeah, the plan suggests that it's already
not himself, but other companies on their behalf. Tell us a bit about what you found out.
Well, there've been a couple of stories during the round. There were some rumors, I gather, in recent weeks suggesting that Gareth Cliff had made his Twitter stream and his Facebook page essentially available to advertisers as a, you know, in that he would provide an endorsement of your brand or your product or your event, but in exchange for what proved to be not so nominal fees. The problem with it, of course, is you know, product placement, endorsement, sponsorship, that sort of thing, age old, and I don't think anyone really has problems with that in a sort of capitalist environment. The problem is suggesting that you can buy an endorsement that pretends to be unsolicited and pretends to be independent, but isn't.
Does that matter though? Because people will find out, and Gareth Cliff will shoot himself in the foot.
Well, sure, but I think to a lot of people, at least on principle, it does matter. You know, it's all good and well. It's great when a celebrity picks up your product and says they love it. You know, obviously it's an absolute marketer's dream, but you know, when it is made to look as if it is a random, unsolicited, unprompted endorsement, but it isn't, I think people feel that they're being taken for a ride. And I think it would be interesting to see, you know, whether they have to revise his rate card because those following numbers change drastically or not. But it's just an interesting one too, with people feeling that it may be an abuse of the position. You know, I think they're saying you're quite welcome to use your channels to promote things that you feel are worthy. But if you're getting a kickback for it, that needs to be disclosed in the same way that, you know, MPs are allowed to receive presents as long as they tell us about them.
Yeah. I mean, I follow Gareth Cliff on Twitter, and the moment he starts, you know, going on about, you know, Toyota is great, or buy this latest book or whatever, I'll simply unfollow him, and I think a lot of people will do the same.
Sure, sure. And that's what I think would be interesting to see, is how it plays out and what the official response is from his PR and so on. I sort of called the number on the rate card, and the gentleman I spoke to, when I asked him if he thought that it would have an impact on Gareth Cliff's sort of social media presence, or at least his impact, he said no, because to their mind, he's not doing anything wrong. He's not selling databases or selling private information about his followers. And I just sort of feel that sort of misses the point.
Yeah, it does kind of, doesn't it? Yeah. It's a really interesting one. I've had a couple of phone calls personally from PR agencies asking me how much I would charge if I tweeted about their client. One of them wanted me to go to one of their clients' events and sit there and tweet through it, and they pay me to do that. And I just laughed at them and said, go away. But
sure, but the point is that there are a lot of people who wouldn't laugh it off.
True.
And I think, you know, particularly in the face of all these media tribunals lately and you know, the related matters, for people, it's just a matter of integrity. They just want
absolutely
and disclosure, and the value of disclosure for your brand and for the sort of you know, the integrity you're trying to sell.
Absolutely. I think integrity for journalists is paramount. If you, the moment you do that, you will lose all your credibility as a journalist that you spend years building up.
Sure, precisely. It's exactly like restaurant reviewers, going in, you know, having pre-announced their arrival, or motoring journalists or tech journalists or any sort of journalists accepting freebies and then lauding a product that they wouldn't have had they had to pay for it.
Absolutely.
I think it's all about this issue of integrity, and that's what's really riling people up, because since the stories about this broke this morning, there's been a lot of talk about it on Twitter and so on, and a lot of people clearly feel a lot more strongly about this than we do.
Good. Well, I'm sure your column's going to be very well read. Craig, I think we need to take a quick break there. We'll be back right after these messages.
The Vox Superphone and your ADSL line go together like taxis and rush hour. But we do give a hoot. Now you can use your ADSL for more than just surfing. With the Superphone, you can call any phone, anywhere, using your ADSL line. You save money, earn rebates, and box-to-box calls are free. No contracts, just plug and play. Your ADSL and the Vox Superphone. It's the perfect combination. Make the most of your ADSL. Visit voxsuperphone.co.za.
After the advent of the telephone, it took mankind 70 years to invent the color television. And yet, it only took the next 23 years to invent lasers, the internet, to put a man on the moon. Ignition sequence start. It begs the question, what will the business world be like in the next 23 years? Wherever your business is at, Telkom Business will be there with you. Telkom Business.
Virtual Access, ECN's latest cost-saving telecom service. Virtual Access is a single 0860 number, providing your customers with national access to your company, no matter how many branches you have or where your customers are calling from. If you are currently using or plan to use an 0860 number, you need to talk to ECN. Virtual Access is the best price single national number offering in the market. For more, visit ecntelecoms.com. ECN, lowering the cost of doing business.
Welcome back to Talk Central, the business technology podcast brought to you by the editors at techcentral.co.za. My name is Duncan McLeod. I'm here with Craig Wilson. Craig, you sat up quite late the other night and watched Steve Jobs' keynote, Apple keynote at the Worldwide Developers Conference.
I did, for my sins. Yeah.
Made quite a few announcements around iCloud and iTunes Match and around the Mac, new Mac operating system codenamed Lion. And what was the other big announcement? Oh, iOS 5, the new operating system for the iPad.
For the handsets. For mobile devices.
Mobile devices. What does your take away from the event? Do you think it lived up to the hype?
Well, I think, frankly, they seldom do live up to the hype, unless there's an enormous announcement or it's something, you know, of the level of, say, the first iPhone or the first iPad. Mm. You know, hype is the key word, and it was absolutely hyped up beyond belief, supposedly because of trouble last time with too much interference from mobile phones and so on. No one was allowed to video stream the actual event, but sure enough, by about halfway through, someone had managed to get their cell phone camera streaming, so you could actually watch it. But I think in many ways it was the announcements were anticlimactic. I think there were a couple of highlights, which I'll come back to in a minute, but you know, particularly from an Apple shareholders or investors' point of view, no hardware means a dull session. You know, they want to see Apple selling products because that's where the markup is. You don't make money on software; you make money on selling the things that run it.
To be fair, though, it is a software developers conference, but they have announced hardware at previous WWDC events, haven't they? I think they announced one of the iPhone versions at WWDC.
Sure, and the iOS 5 obviously would be, you know, for the pending iPhone 5 announcement that's expected around September, if not sooner. But I think the most interesting thing, personally, to come out of the whole announcement was not only iCloud, but specifically the iTunes Match.
Mm, that did look interesting.
I think that's the most incredible part of it.
Do we know if that's coming to South Africa?
As far as I know, it is. What would be curious there is, I gather that
because the iTunes Music Store isn't available here, so to South Africa, I mean, you have to put in a US address. So, and you know, the service allows you to download higher quality versions of music you already own or music you've already pirated.
Well, that's the interesting thing, man. I don't know whether it will be available here. That's the point. I'll have to look into that. But yeah. I think what makes it really incredible is that Jobs has, on the one hand, raised a middle finger to the music industry, but on the other hand has extended a hand and said, well, look, we figured out how we're going to sort out this problem of people wanting to stream media and people wanting everything digitally, and we'll give you a cut, which is better than you could have necessarily hoped for otherwise.
I wonder what that cut is of the $24.99.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, is the price. For a mere $25 a year, you can essentially legitimize 100 gigs of pirated music.
Mm, that's the cost of two CDs.
Exactly, yeah. Which I think also makes it an incredible proposition, because for people, you know, who have enormous libraries, the worry was, and you could even hear the people who were sort of giving commentary as the announcements were made, when the first announcement about iCloud syncing your music and your pictures and so on, with qualifiers, came out, all the commentators said, but no mention about ripped CDs, no mention about MP3s. And sure enough, that proved to be the final big announcement, was this iTunes
one
match.
One more thing, yeah.
Yes, the one more thing, the magic one. And I think that's really interesting. We'll have to see once it's actually implemented and rolled out. You know, we've got a couple of months to wait before it takes off properly. They also haven't specified, I gathered that music wasn't included in the 5 gigs of free iCloud space that they're going to be giving Apple users. So how they're going to work if you have, you know, they said anything between 5 and 20,000 songs, but obviously, you know, whether they're assuming that, say, 5 megs a song, you know, it's difficult to work out how much space you're actually going to be afforded, because I'm sure that, you know, Apple are going to be reluctant, even though with the iTunes match, which rather than storing your music goes, well, we've got it in the iTunes store, and it literally just makes a sort of marker that tells it to play the iTunes version rather than uploading yours. It's still going to be difficult for people who have particularly unusual taste or a very a collection of things that the iTunes store can't replicate, as to how much space Apple are actually going to give each user, and if they are going to charge an additional amount for extra space, how much is that going to be?
Yeah, good point. And also, I also wonder what it means for people with fairly esoteric music tastes like myself.
Exactly.
I collect a vast range of progressive rock from the 1960s onwards, and half of that music is not available in the iTunes store. So
sure, absolutely. Or even, you know, youngsters who are big local music fans. I mean, one of the jokes has been that one of the things you can't really pirate very easily is South African music, unless it's hand-to-hand. You know, you don't go onto the usual torrent sites or the usual peer-to-peer networks and search for, you know, Dan Patlansky. You can try, but chances are nothing's going to come up.
Yeah.
Unless a thoughtful American who once saw him at a show has taken the CD home and ripped it and made it available.
Mm.
You know, it's particularly difficult if you have niche interests, or at least, you know, globally niche. That sort of stuff just isn't available. So I'm curious to see how this plays out. I think some of the announcements were good. We were talking last week about the value we saw in Windows Phone 7, or the fact that the new Windows 8 is going to be designed to work on all devices.
Yes.
And that seems to be a sort of a top-down approach as opposed to, a bottom-up approach as opposed to the other way around. I think iOS 5 shows that that maybe Windows may actually have the better approach, because what they've done is they've incorporated so much of the gestures, so many of the gestures and so much of the interface that they've learned from mobile devices, that's now going to be, going into Lion, so that you can enjoy the same sort of functionality on your desktop or your laptop. And I think that's a really interesting progression as well, is that the way we're actually interacting with devices is shifting because of the kinds of devices that are becoming more and more prevalent. You know, touch gestures on a laptop just a few years ago, you know, even multi-gestures were revolutionary. You know, two-finger scroll was something no one else had done. And I think we're going to see a lot more development in this, particularly as touchscreens become more more commonplace. And it's just interesting that they've taken developments from, you know, arguably lower down in the hierarchy of products, and they're boosting them. They're putting them into things like Lion for actual PC operation, as opposed to Windows, who've opted to just try and make things, or Microsoft, should I say, who've just tried to make things work on everything simultaneously.
Yeah, interesting. My biggest disappointment out of this Apple keynote was iOS 5. I don't think they went nearly far enough in what they needed to do to keep pace with Android and with Windows Phone 7. Particularly disappointing is that despite the clamor for it, they're still not offering true multitasking in the operating system.
No, absolutely. And a lot of the other things that were announced, it does feel a little bit like, for a change, Apple is playing catch up, which is an unusual situation for them to be in.
Yeah, I mean, I made that point in a column and got slammed for it. I think that a lot of what we saw this week was catch up by Apple towards Amazon, Microsoft, and some of the stuff that Google's done. There were a few new things. I mean, iTunes Match was certainly a new and unique development. But many of the things that they've incorporating into iOS and some of the things they're putting into Lion are really some of them maybe a bit catch up, and others are certainly not revolutionary by any stretch of the imagination.
Sure, and some of them they've wanted to punt as such. I mean, by way of example, the talk of iMessage, arguably long overdue, but in the face of multi-platform apps like WhatsApp, you've got to wonder just how much penetration they hope to achieve with something like iMessage. You know, we've seen BBM threatened by programs like WhatsApp or anything that is multi-platform.
Yeah.
And I just don't see how launching another proprietary message system is going to do them any favors.
No, not for, I mean, it has to be multi-platform.
Indeed, they have to open it up to developers, or they have to make it somehow multi-platform available. Otherwise,
it won't work. It won't succeed. It's the same reason FaceTime is never really going to be a big mass market thing, because it only works on Apple devices.
Absolutely, yeah.
Anyway, sticking with matters Apple, kind of, we've got South Africa's getting its first iPad-only newspaper. Our friends over at the Daily Maverick are launching a daily newspaper on the iPad and later other tablets to follow, called iMaverick. Interesting model they've come up with. They're going to be giving away an iPad. I put it giving away in inverted commas, an iPad as part of a subscription. It's going to be the first iPad or tablet-only newspaper in the country, as far as I know. And good luck to them.
Absolutely. I think we both feel that we don't love the name, but I certainly love the idea. And I think they're also talking about growing. You know, I spoke to the deputy editor, Philip DeWitt, about the pending launch of iMaverick, and they're not looking at. He was a bit candid when a bit guarded when I asked who they saw their immediate opposition as, and he said, "Well, all readership really, because they're looking to grow this into a fully fledged newspaper. It'll be lifestyle sections and expanded sports and politics and entertainment and all the sorts of things you'd expect from a normal day to day publication." I think they're clearly punting the iPad angle very heavily. And I believe it's going to be a little while after launch before it'll be available on other platforms, which I think is an interesting decision. I mean, perhaps they were obliged to. I don't really know what.
Well, iPad does dominate the tablet space worldwide and in South Africa for now. So I think launching on the iPad first makes the most sense, because that's where the market is.
Sure. It just seems curious because, even the development we've seen in the tablet market in the last couple of months, by their launch date in August, there could be quite a lot more tablets on the market, and I just feel like you should try and cover all the bases. But understandably, the iPad, as you said, is the bestseller, without doubt. I just think it's really exciting that they've seen the potential in this, and they've seen how technology like tablet computing has absolutely taken off. And it's just nice that there's something like that out there. And I think it's a very sensible decision for them. The Daily Maverick itself was a sort of spin-off from the editor's previous forays into print publishing. And, I think that was the first step, was realizing, well, perhaps, we're not doing well enough in print. We'll take it online. And then this feels like the next step in the sort of Maverick brand's evolution.
I mean, if I've got one criticism of it, I think it does look too expensive. If you look at the subscription price, I haven't got it in front of me here. I don't know if you remember what it is, Craig.
Well, I don't know if we have one without the... I mean, I know what it is with the iPad.
With the iPad.
It's $395 a month
for a 16-gigabyte Wi-Fi-only iPad. Now, if you work that out over the 24-month subscription period that you have to take out, you end up paying, I think, around twice for the iPad as what you would if you bought it up front from an Apple retailer. So that does look expensive. So you effectively half of the price is going into the subscription. So around just over 200 Rand or so is going into the into the subscription for the product, which seems very expensive if you compare it to other iPad only newspapers like the Daily, Rupert Murdoch's publication, or even
some print publication,
even expensive compared to, say, the New York Times on the iPad, which you can subscribe to for about $19 a month. So it does look pricey. So I do wonder if they've thought that one through clearly, because it does seem a little pricey.
Sure, and they, I was told they're aiming for 20,000 to 25,000 subscribers in the first year, and they haven't yet released the standalone subscription fee. And I think that'll be really interesting to see when that comes out. You know, how much it costs you if you're already an iPad user?
Yeah.
Because also, I think that's going to be a lot of the target market. Never mind new people wanting to get iPads. Mm. It's people, existing iPad owners, who are going to be very interested in what they're offering.
If it is $200 a month for the standalone subscription, then I think that's too much, because you can subscribe to the print edition of Business Day for around that price, which is a very good daily print newspaper, which obviously has a lot more cost associated with it.
Absolutely. I think people are going to find it very hard to justify spending the same sort of money they could spend on a print publication on this.
Mm.
I think part of the appeal of this is meant to be that, you know, not only is it more convenient, but that it shouldn't cost as much. The overheads should be lower.
Yeah.
But it'll be interesting to see. I think it's an exciting development either way.
It is. It is. And good luck to them. I think they've done a great job with the Daily Maverick online. I've known Branko Brkić, the editor, for many years, and he's certainly passionate about the stuff. So.
I mean, I'm very partial to, I mean, the Daily Maverick I've been reading since shortly after they launched.
Mm.
I think it's a great site. I like what they do. And I think they're also just a great player in the space, because they are so fiercely unbeholden to anyone. They do write whatever they wish. And it's good to have such blatantly independent and proudly independent media out there.
Mm, definitely. Cool. Before we wrap it up this week, Craig, Monday is the big Telkom results day. I thought we'd have a quick chat about what we can expect out of that. Keep an eye on Tech Central on Monday. We're going to have hopefully the market-leading coverage on the results.
And updates all day and lots of analysis.
Updates all day and interviews, etc. So Craig and I will both be at Santon Convention Center to cover those results and do all the interviews with the executives and unpack it all. But I don't know what you think, what your take on this is, but I'm certainly going to be looking closely at their fixed line subscriber numbers. Those have been declining year after year for many years now. I'd like to see whether there's any sign of stabilization on that line, or whether indeed fixed line mobile substitution is in fact accelerating, which was what it appeared to be the case at the interim results 6 months ago.
I'm also curious to see what effect in the final results ATA has actually had. How much damage to their bottom line it's wrecked in the last, since launch.
Well, we have some indication, because they said 1.1 billion rand operating loss associated with the ATA startup costs. So,
indeed.
So, it'll be interesting to see how many subscribers they've signed up, and more specifically, what the average revenue per user is from those subscribers.
Sure, because that's the magic number, really, in these cases.
And how many of these customers churn to ATA to try it out and churn back again to the operator they were with before. And then obviously broadband and the growth in DSL subscriber numbers, I think, is a key one, because that's that's one of the few growth areas for Telkom.
Yes.
they've been rolling out Foster Broadband. They've upgraded some 4 meg users to 10 megs, and they're in the process, where they've just concluded the process of upgrading some of their 512 megabit per second users to 1 megabit per second one megabit per second. I think any sign of slowing growth in the DSL market would be of great concern to analysts, because that has really been Telkom's growth engine, especially in the retail consumer market.
Sure.
Good.
Can we leave it there?
Let's wrap it up there. Thanks very much, Craig. If you've got any feedback on the show, you can email us at info@techcentral.co.za. Until next Friday, have a great weekend. Cheers. Bye.